Chaplain Eva Bleeker, welcome to the Real Humans Podcast.
I'm happy to be welcomed into this space, Tristan. Thanks for having
Absolutely.
me.
Yeah, you are welcome. And I'm so excited to talk to you today and that you've become a part of the Real Humans family, because the reality is we have known each other for a long time.
How when did we meet, Tristan? Do you remember?
Okay, so Eva, we met. I can tell you where we met. I can't tell you like when, because we met at Dallas Seminary,
We
right?
did.
And I got to Dallas Seminary in the fall of 2006. And so that had to be around the time that we would have met each other, known each other, because at that time, you were in the admissions office, if I'm not mistaken.
You are. Josh was in admissions,
Okay, sorry. Josh was in admissions.
but you're not wrong in that I
Okay.
was one floor up working for Chaplain Bill Bryan.
Yes, Chaplain. Oh, I miss him. I miss him so much.
I do too.
Yeah.
Life
Wonderful, wonderful man of God.
yeah.
And so the reason we were able to reconnect is actually because of your husband, Josh Bleeker. So shout out to Josh Bleeker.
Come on.
One of the most kind and generous people that I've ever met. And I'm sure he'll tell you that I probably, when I worked for custodial at DTS, that I destroyed stuff in his office with my Ghostbusters backpack. So we don't have to have a conversation about that. But I'm sure I left some carnage with that thing. And so shout out to Josh. And then he reached out to me because I found a quote of yours. Eva, I can't tell you where I found the quote, but I was like, this is fire. I'm putting it up, I'm stowing it away, because I need to keep this for where I am in my life. And the quote is, I want to read it so I don't botch it up, because I think that our audience, the people listening to this podcast, they need to sit with this quote, right? And you said, it will cost you to serve in the hard places of people's lives.
That sounds like something I said, Tristan.
Yeah. And Eva, that has stayed with me. And so I want to talk more about the quote in a second. But Chaplain Eva, we're going to start. So I want to start with the past, and then I'm going to move forward with you. Okay. So first question is, I'm sorry, where did you grow up, and what was your favorite thing to do as a kid?
Oh my goodness. So, the where did you grow up is a simple question with a complicated answer. So, I was born in the Dakotas, and before I turned a year old, my daddy enrolled at Dallas Theological Seminary, our alma mater. So, I lived the first 4 years of my life in Dallas, which is why I have this lilt to my voice that shows up. I learned to speak in Texas. Then I started public school in the Big Valley of California, the big growing valley. We lived in a town called Lodi. We
Oh,
moved
God.
from we moved from there to Calgary, Alberta, Canada. So we moved from a place where you may need a jacket in December to a beautiful but very different part of North America. That was an outstanding developmental experience for me to live up there. And then when I was about 10 years old, we moved back to the States and I went to junior high school and high school in a small town in the middle of Kansas. I consider Ellenwood, Kansas to be one of my two homes. It is, I mean, if everybody is at their grandparents' house, there might be 2,500 people there. I went from there to Kansas State. I met Josh.
Kansas
He
State, okay.
Fabulous and forenamed in this conversation, Josh Bleeker.
Yes.
My husband of 24 years already.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And we went together back to Dallas. We traded places going to seminary and were there for 14 years. That's where chaplaincy and you enter my story. Mm-hmm. We moved from there to Washington, D.C. We lived there for 5 years. I went to school in New York City. And then in 2019, we moved to the Front Range of Colorado, which is where I am sitting while we're recording this conversation. So
yeah.
Home and where did you grow up is a little bit longer answer, but okay. I do hope to remain in place here in Colorado for a while.
Yeah.
Texas and Kansas will permanently be in my map of home.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because as you were talking about, Kansas, mm-hmm. I was like, I can't tell you anything about Kansas except for the fact that barbecue sauce, Kansas City.
I mean, yes.
You know,
that's a thing.
And a man who I dearly love is from there, who was my tour, discipled me growing up. And so, and then you. So now you have become part of the Kansas story in my life.
There we go. I'm so glad.
So we've talked about kind of the different places that you've been growing up. And so what was your favorite thing to do as a kid?
Well, I think for in the frame of this conversation,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to name reading fiction as my favorite thing. I mean, I love to be outdoors and I always loved animals and things like that. But the way that story has shaped my understanding of self and other, of the way that God comes to us, the way that we heal. Mm-hmm. I think all of that is embedded, maybe got its seed planted in those conversations,
yes.
in those times I spent in books and being mm-hmm. exposed to stories that were different than my own when I was growing up. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're gonna come to your research interests a little bit later. So for me, I love this because as a mental health professional, I love connecting dots.
Yeah.
You know, I love doing, so I'm like, okay, the narrative, the fiction, you know, what she was doing as a kid, I'm like, this is connecting with exactly what she's doing right now. So we're going to come to that.
Okay.
And so Real Humans is about having conversations around passion and mental health. And so we know that you're in Colorado right now. And so would you tell our audience what it is that you do out in Colorado?
I get to work a job I did not see coming, Tristan. When you and I met and we were both seminary students, I never imagined myself at the front of a seminary classroom, but that's what I do now. So I'm an assistant professor in chaplaincy and pastoral care at Denver Seminary, and I'm the chair of pastoral care and counseling programs. So I after spending 10 years in clinical chaplaincy, I have pivoted to the classroom. I get to teach other people about things like what brought us together for this conversation. Like, what does it mean? What is it going to cost you if you choose to step into these difficult places? So I'm in the academy now. I never saw it coming, but when I look backward, when I look at the reconstruction of my story behind me, I can see how this makes sense and the ways that the Lord brought me here.
Absolutely. Because, you know, I think that we're going to talk. I want to transition into just your work in terms of chaplaincy, and then I want to come back to your academic work as well, because as I was thinking about you, I'm like, okay, so she is a certified professional chaplain, and so you are on the front lines of caring for people, and so how did you come to work in chaplaincy, pastoral care? Like, I know the, and so like all of these dots are connecting for me now. You work for Chaplain Bill. So,
yes.
You know, there's a question coming that I'm like, okay, who are the people who have really influenced you? And I'm like, you worked under a chaplain. And so I'm like,
Exactly.
so how did chaplaincy come about and pastoral care work come about for you?
Such a good question. And as you know, in what you do, there are a lot of different places where I could start this.
Oh,
but
yes.
You know what? Let's dedicate this conversation to the Reverend G. William Bryan. He changed my life.
Yes.
And he, so starting with this, I don't know if you know this, but he took a chance on me. I was the first woman ever to serve as the assistant to the chaplain at Dallas Seminary. And I didn't know that stepping into that would be somewhat pioneering and certainly different for people who had been around Dallas Seminary for, you know,
Yes.
many decades.
Yes.
But Chaplain Bill, he invited me into that role. I did not know, Tristan, when I said yes to the job, that in addition to helping with student needs and helping with certainly at the time, the four chapels a week that we were running on the Dallas Seminary campus, that a part of that job, part of what Chaplain Bill received me into, was a formal mentoring relationship. So when I'd been in the job for maybe a week, and Chaplain Bill came into my office, he pulled the door shut behind me and he said, "I've got something to tell you. There's a scholarship associated with this position. And there is a formal mentoring aspect." So he would intentionally bring me into pastoral care conversations. We would occasionally make a visit to a member of the Dallas Seminary family over at the hospital next door, which I did not know at the time was in my future, but we'd go over to Baylor to visit folks.
Yes.
And so yes. my understanding of what pastoral care could be as a vocation started with Bill Bryan. And when I graduated, so you came in 2006, I graduated in
right.
2008.
Okay, yep.
I had a challenge finding work when I graduated, and it felt like my expectations and hope for myself post-seminary had fallen down a very long flight of stairs. And I had hit every stair on the way down. I mean, just
Oh my
everything
gosh.
That I tried, everything that I applied for, and the things that I had imagined would be important for me at seminary graduation all failed. And I interpreted that as personal failure. And one day I Googled three words: ministry, jobs, Dallas. And the first hit I got was for a chaplaincy position at that same hospital next door to where we went to school. And within a month or so, I had interviewed to enter their chaplaincy training program. So I did a year residency in pastoral care there at Baylor's Teaching Hospital, which is now under the Baylor Scott and White Medical System, which you know.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And it was the hardest work I'd ever done. It was the most exciting time I'd had in learning that I'd ever had. And I think even though it was disorienting and challenging in many directions, physically among them, I knew within a couple of weeks that I was hoping to stay in the field. So that's how I got into it. Baylor did an outstanding job of training me in that clinical model where you move toward patients and then you come back and reflect with a supervisor who knows how to support that immersive learning. And then I stayed. It took me 8 years to get board certified. It's fraught with peril, but I did eventually get board certified. And actually, my commissioning church is right there in East Dallas. Skillman Bible Church continues to back me in my call to chaplaincy, and so they will always be my my sending church and my commissioning church.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, for, you know, you brought something new into my ecosystem with you being a pioneer. And like I said, I feel like my brain is on fire right now because so many dots are just connecting right now. And of course, we have the relationship with Chaplain Bill Bryan and that he was a wonderful, wonderful man. But I was thinking about him and I was, you know, Chaplain Bill, he was very active. And one of the things that I learned about Chaplain Bill is that he would tell you exactly what's on his mind.
So true.
He was just, he just put it out there. And I remember, I can't tell you what I was doing or anything else like that. But I remember one day he pulled me to the side and he said, son, you don't start gaining your wings. You don't take off in ministry until about 40. And I was like, okay, well, Chaplain, what are you doing up until that point? And then he said, you're gaining altitude. So I was like,
yes.
I was like, okay, yeah. So that is a Chaplain Bill moment that I have tucked away. Uh-huh. And so I'm like, so as I hear you talking about him and pouring into your life, I thought, you know, it makes perfect sense that you are in the chaplaincy pastoral care space, because it sounds like one of the major formation points for you was intersecting with Chaplain Bill during your time here at DTS. Oh, the other thing, Eva, I was going to say was with you being a woman in that role, I thought, well, that's amazing. And that comes on the heels, because I mean, with here at Dallas Seminary, I mean, I think we just started admitting women in the 80s, if I'm not mistaken.
If you're wrong, you're very close to the, I don't know what year it was.
Okay.
It was in 1950, let's say.
No, it wasn't. It was not. No. And so we talked a little bit earlier about the costs associated with serving in the hard places of people's lives. And so I wanted to ask you, for you, what have been some of the costs associated with your work and your calling to pastoral care?
Mm-hmm. Great question. Mm-hmm. And every great question has lots of ways to answer it, right?
So I'll
tell you the way that I first became aware of how costly it is to be a genuine companion to people who are suffering. So when I went into the program at Baylor Hospital to learn how to be a chaplain, this is a level one trauma center. At the time it was 1,000 beds. I don't know if it still is, but you know, some of the most violent and medically complex emergencies from across Dallas-Fort Worth would come through our emergency department. And we were doing all sorts of really complicated medicine to save people's lives. And so I'll give a couple of examples of what I mean by what it costs.
Yes. Yes.
One is in an area that I like to term a theology of witness. And when I say witness, I am not referring to the opportunities that we have to scripturally share our faith with words. Yes. I mean, with my body standing by and looking with clear eyes at the suffering of another image bearer.
Yes.
And to believe that part of my way of being present in ministry at that moment is to bear witness to that suffering. So that is costly for me, but I think it is an essential service to the person who's suffering. That a language that I really like comes from a mental health provider up in the Northeast. He's no longer living, but his name is Dory Lobb. And he has a phrase that he uses in his provision of care called event without a witness. And it's the idea that a person who has experienced trauma may not be able to even relate that account of suffering to themselves without someone else who is willing to bear witness with them. So if I'm willing to step into that space and witness that event so that the person who is at the center of the experience is not alone in it and has the benefit that, I'm saying benefit, that essential listener, if I do that, then we get into some terminology where you're more qualified than I am, like secondary trauma.
Yes.
You know about the ways that the things that we internalize mentally and psychologically have a cost for the entirety of our personhood.
Absolutely.
So for me, one of the costs is often that my sleep is disrupted.
Okay.
One of the ways that I notice when I'm experiencing cost is that I start eating like I'm in the NFL. Like I just never saw a snack I didn't want. So those are small things. Those are small things that I notice about myself. And when I check in and I think I haven't slept well for 10 days and all of my self-control seems to be gone, what is happening to me? And what I might find if I'm self-checking or in dialogue with a good listener is that as I have voluntarily moved towards suffering, I am choosing to be a participant. It is my volition moving me toward a choice to participate in suffering. So you can call that a theological truth or a social reality or a psychological principle, but that when wherever I may have said this, Tristan, about it costing us to serve in the hard places of people's lives, that is not only at the center of my ministry. My ministry is coming, I hope, from what I see modeled Christologically in this willingness to donate the self on behalf of the suffering other. The volitional piece is really important because we never want to suggest to other people that they need to do something that is not according to their own conscience. Yes. But for me, I believe it is my calling, and I believe it is my honor when I get to move toward people who are having the worst experience of their lives and choose participation in that event.
Yes. I love what you said about the volition piece, talking about the willingness to be able to move towards people who are in suffering. And the other thing that I thought about with people like us who are on the front lines of caring for people, and we talk about compassion fatigue. And so yes. You go, yeah, so you understand, like, okay, if I'm going to do this, what are the costs associated with this work, right? Because, you know, we have all the natural inclinations, the gifts and abilities, people telling us, oh, you should work with people, you know, you should do this. But I'm just remembering, nobody ever tells you, okay, well, this is what this is actually like. This is what you're going to go through. Mm-hmm. If you choose to be in the role where you are in pastoral care, if you're a mental health clinician, wherever you are on the spectrum of caring for people, and we cannot leave out the impact that COVID has had, oh my gosh, on our world and on our healthcare system. Mm-hmm. It's been amazing. So just wanting the people out there to understand, like, that if you choose a helping profession, particularly with people, then you're asking to move into have spaces in your life or times where you're going to have compassion fatigue.
Yes.
Yeah.
I couldn't agree more, Tristan. And I think when I so I'm looking at what you're saying now, as someone who shepherds students as well as somebody who has experienced this, as you mentioned, kind of somebody on the front line of medical crisis.
Yep.
And something I notice, and maybe I can notice this because it may have been true of me.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, maybe I can spot this because it's part of my own story, but
absolutely.
The ways that we narrativize the helping careers, as you have mentioned, maybe lack this component of what the cost is. And something else that I think may be part of this, so I'm going to borrow some language from a philosopher named Judith Butler. And Dr. Butler talks about how sometimes what we imagine is love, my love for being a hospital chaplain, sometimes what feels like love is really us being compelled by our own opacity and the places that are unexamined in our own lives. So I am guilty. That's not a good phrase. I recognize myself in that. There's nothing wrong.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that's true of all of us. It doesn't need to be guilt. But I recognize that when I felt invitation of Holy Spirit to move toward a career in pastoral care, I didn't know all of the things that were driving me there. And some of them are healthy, some of them are unhealthy. And so being in dialogue with other people who I trust, that helps turn that opacity to self into at least partial transparency, so that I can apprehend within myself, is it my need to be a hero that drives me into applying for a job in emergency room chaplaincy? Is it my own family's stories of suffering with cancer that makes me want to apply for the job as the oncology chaplain? Is it the places where I have been denied access to a job in pastoral ministry that makes me want to move toward that? So all of those things are places that I need to, with the same non-judgmental stance I hope I would have in a pastoral counseling conversation, turn that look inward and say, these are things I probably need to sort out before I imagine that I am moving with love towards someone who needs my support.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, so you said, a word that I don't know what it means. So you said,
there then.
Opacity. What does that mean? What does that mean?
So opacity is in the same family word group as the word opaque. It means you can't see through it.
Okay, you can't see it. Okay.
You can't see through it, right?
Gotcha.
So hopefully a pane of glass is transparent. And so when I'm looking out my window, I'm getting an accurate view of what's on the other side of the street. But if I'm looking at the wall, I cannot see what might be on the other side of that. So when we talk about, thank you for letting me unpack this.
No, it's okay.
When we talk about opacity to self and that inability to identify what we are experiencing as love for other, what we want to do is be in the kinds of relationships that moves that solid wall that I see when I look inward to a transparency where I can say, I might need to do some more of my own healing work before I'm ready to do full-time acute care chaplaincy.
Absolutely.
That is not theoretical. That is something that I discovered in myself.
Absolutely. 100%. And I think kind of one of the things that came up for me as you were talking about that is that for all of us in the helping profession, all of our whys, it's complex and it's varied, right? So I'm sitting in class with Andy Thacker, Dr. Andy Thacker here,
yes,
in normal human development. Love Dr. Thacker. And Andy says, "Oh, yeah, all of y'all became therapists because you want to fix your families." And I was like, "Oh yeah, that makes sense. That makes perfect sense, right?" So it's like, yeah. So it's one of those things, like, because we've seen suffering firsthand, we've experienced suffering firsthand, and we want to deal with it and do something about it. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Yes.
So to your point, you know, you talked about so good, like you said, the way that we narratize, and the word that came to my mind was we romanticize.
Oh,
sometimes
so true.
The work of working with people and all the, you know, good things, that those things are true, but I feel that sometimes there's no balance.
Yes.
Right? To say, okay, here are the mountains, but here are the valleys as well that you're going to go through
Yes.
too.
I think romanticizing the field is something that we're all prone to do. I mean, I honestly, Tristan, I think probably the first time I was aware that there was a role for chaplaincy in hospitals, I saw some foolishness on TV, which has nothing to do with the real job or what actually happens. And I think too that when you quote Dr. Thacker, boy, I mean that's so powerful.
She just, yeah.
It's true, but it's not bad, right?
No, it's not. No.
We all feel this call, this inward draw to be healers because we are acutely aware of the need for healing.
Absolutely.
We just want to make sure that we're not trying to fix ourselves when we need to be focused on somebody else, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So, so we mentioned some of the costs associated with it. So for you, what have been some of your joys in chaplaincy pastoral ministry?
It would take a long time to enumerate them, but for myself personally, one of the things I loved the most about doing clinical ministry was being welcomed into the life of a stranger and seeing the Lord work in that space, whether or not we ever named him, but knowing that he was there.
Yes.
And
yes.
Also, I never walked out of work wondering if I did something important or purposeful. In acute care chaplaincy, the needs are so plain that I never had to wonder if I did something meaningful that day. So I loved that. I love that hospitals are teaching places. There's always something to learn. And for me, being in this great big hospital where there were literally people from around the world who had come from every continent to receive care at our hospital. So that kind of diversity, but then also I got to see who actually lives in Dallas, Texas. They were all here. There,
yes.
You know, I might have the family of a professional athlete next door to an unhoused U.S. military veteran, and we're providing the same care for those people. So I don't know if this counts as joy, but I will say one of the more fulfilling and important learning experiences for me of working in that kind of medical setting was seeing plainly structural injustices.
Okay. Yep.
What might be true and untrue about equity in the provision of care, and then making real equity of care the center of my goal as a chaplain, to own. I mean, I think people are just going to be listening to us, Tristan, but I will just say, I am a white female.
Yep.
And
Absolutely.
I have had the benefit of education And I have to own what that means when I am working in a position that carries with it authority. I have to own the capacity to do harm. I have to be quick to be humble and ask for forgiveness and do a lot more listening than speaking. I think joy comes from those places of learning outside a library.
Oh yeah, and in a classroom. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I love the library. Yeah.
But. Don't get me wrong. I love the library. Love Starbucks. I'm an introvert.
Me too.
I mean, you know, like most of us, most people who listen to podcasts, like we're introverts. Like we recharge by being by ourselves, right?
Yes.
And so Chaplain Eva, what I want to do is I want to come back with you. And do another part to our interview.
That would be great.
Because just right now I'm kind of on a clock right now. So let's come back and do a part two, and then we'll finish it out. Okay, let's do it.
All right.
Awesome. Thank you.
You are so welcome.
Absolutely.